We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. Going back a very long way, blue water sailors and people who have lived by the ocean have told stories of giant waves. Also for a long time, scientists who heard those stories said they were just that. They were stories. They said a wave of 90, 100 feet was physically impossible. Well, now we know that indeed these waves do exist. And where there are waves, there are people who are fascinated by them. Scientists who want to understand them, and that's important because they can be very, very destructive. And then there are those people who are fascinated by those waves because they want to ride them. This morning, in this hour of Focus, we'll talk a little bit about both of these groups of people. And that's a story that he's told in a book that's titled The Wave. It's now out in paperback. It's published by Anchor Books. And the guest this morning is the author, Susan Casey. She's a journalist. She's editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine. She's a National Magazine award-winning journalist. Her work has been featured in a number of places: the Best American Science and Nature Writing, Best American Sports Writing, Best American Magazine Writing, a lot of other places as well. She's the author of the book The Devil's Teeth, A True Story of Obsession and Survival Among America's Great White Sharks, and also the new one, The Wave. Questions are welcome as we talk with Susan Casey. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line that's good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. And if you'd like to send an email, you may do that as well. The address is WILL, got to put in a hyphen there, Will Talk. That's the second time this week I've done that. How about Will Talk? Will-talk@illinois.edu if you want to write in. Or, of course, you can also give us a call. And Ms. Casey, hello.
Hello.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Please call me Susan.
Oh, all right. The story comes together in a number of ways, and I think that you began to be interested in waves and in people who are into waves a number of different ways, and maybe one week we could start is to talk a little bit about surfing. And I know that you have surfed. You've been a competitive swimmer, and you actually got hurt surfing on not a very big wave. And I know that you tell the story about having been on vacation and seeing people on pretty big waves and thinking to yourself, that was just knowing what your experience had been with maybe a littler wave. You saw these people on these 30-foot waves, and you said it was just terrifying.
Oh, I remember the first time I saw, I don't even think it was a 30-foot wave. It's probably about a 20-foot wave, which at this point, after spending 5 years in pursuit of the biggest waves in the ocean, I would look at a 20-foot wave and think, eh, that's nothing. But at the time, I remember thinking, that is the most terrifying thing I've ever seen in my life. And what is that little ant doing at the top of it? And realizing, no, that's a person, and he's on a surfboard. And having, all, as you said, been put into the hospital by a 4-foot wave, I really wanted to know more about what kind of a person, you know, inserts themselves into the ocean at its most ferocious.
Yeah, that's just you think about a 20-foot wave. Say most people, they have a 2-story house. Okay, that's about 20 feet. So think about a wave as tall as your house. Then start thinking about a wave that would be as tall as a 6-story building or a 10-story building.
Right.
And it's the mind, you can't really quite wrap your mind around, unless maybe you've seen videos of people surfing waves of that caliber.
I don't think a video can do justice to it, because the power that's really coming at you and the power... There's a visceral sense to it that obviously it's awesome to see it on film. It's really awesome, and we're in the process of hoping that the wave will be developed into a documentary for IMAX. But that will give people a very good sense, especially in 3D, of what it's like. But there is really nothing like seeing it, and I'll just never forget the time I saw a wave that was about 70 feet tall. When they get over about 50 feet tall, they start acting differently, and it just I'll never forget exactly what this wave looked like, what it did, what I was feeling at that moment. Like, I can actually feel it even talking to you right now. When they get that big, it takes them longer to break. We think of a wave as sort of building. You see the crest, it breaks, it dissipates. A really big wave marches forward as a vertical wall for an extra second or two, and it's feathering at the top. So it's this real moment of terror, and there's an extra beat or two in there before it actually starts to break. And then, of course, the white water and the tremendous explosive power that's released when it breaks is, you know, you hear it, you feel it. I say in your sternum, you sort of feel it, this reverberation. Yeah, and no matter how good the filmmaking, I don't think you can really capture that.
Yeah. Well, that's interesting because I know you also, another part of this is rogue waves that you might encounter in the open ocean and how important it is to try to understand these things because they're very dangerous to shipping. But one of the things you talk about is when people who have seen these things or perhaps experienced them, they say when you see them, it doesn't look like a wave. It maybe looks like other sorts of things. Maybe you're not even quite sure what it is you're looking at.
Well, one of the reasons why I was so fascinated and wanted to write a book about giant waves was that I had heard the statistic that approximately 2 large ships a week go missing in somewhere in the world's oceans. And I thought, how can this possibly be in an age of GPS? And I mean, we can locate very small things. We can split an atom, and you're losing a 1,000-foot ship, and nobody even knows what happened. And there was never even time in a lot of these instances for them to send a mayday, which is it seemed bizarre to me. And when scientists first considered rogue waves, they didn't really think, it wasn't that they didn't think a 100-foot wave could exist in the open ocean. They knew it could, but they didn't think that a 100-foot wave could exist in 30-foot seas. In other words, like in a place that didn't have a lot of other 100-foot waves around, that it suddenly would come out of the seas at 2, 3, 4, and even more, and even higher than that in terms of the seas around it. That just made no sense. And what was happening was that ships and the models that route the ships and things like that, they were basing them on a very linear notion of what the ocean was capable of. And really what's happening in a rogue wave is it could be 2 or 3 waves superimposed, but the whole adds up to more than the sum of the parts. So you can have a wave that's like this sort of weird, unstable, you know, teetering monster. It doesn't even really look like a wave. It is so much farther away from equilibrium than the waves around it that's kind of coming apart. And generally in the open ocean, the waves don't break very often because they're not feeling the bottom. You know, there's not an object for them to break on. But rogue waves break, and they do all kinds of things that normal waves really, it's just completely different behavior.
Yeah, and I suppose if by the time that you see one of these things, if you're in a ship and you see this thing, there's not much you can do if it decides it's going to come crashing down on you.
Well, you know, they can come from other directions too. They're disobeying the pack rules for all the other waves. So the captain might be holding his bow into the seas in a stormy situation, then one comes from the side or something like that. And of course, you know, lots of ships are caught completely unaware. But it was only 1995 when it was definitively proved that this could happen, and the reason that it was proved was a rogue wave hit an oil rig, an 85-foot wave in 38-foot seas, and it was measured by lasers, and they probably would have dismissed the laser measurement as a mistake, an anomaly, you know, a piece of data that didn't belong, but the wave also hit the rig at that level and damaged it, so there was clear scientifically acceptable proof that an 85-foot wave had popped out of these 38-foot seas, and at that point, scientists really had to stand back and go, okay, they really do exist. But that wasn't very long ago. When you think of something as incredibly, you know, as you said, dangerous and volatile and obvious in the ocean, really, it's not like they just started happening in 1995. The ocean has always created these waves.
So you think that the fact that people have told stories about waves like that going back a long time, that these kinds of waves, they've always been there. It's just that now, within the relatively recent past, we have scientists who have actually managed to measure them so that they can say, yes, I have data. I can show you numbers. I just don't have a story about it.
Right. I mean, because a lot of the times people who would encounter a 100-foot rogue wave out in the ocean wouldn't come back. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't be back on land again to tell about it. And also, of course, you know, scientists want definitive proof. And how do you it's very hard to measure precisely a wave and what's going on. And one of the things that was also extraordinary was that in 2000, I believe I opened the book with this, the story of the RRS Discovery, which is a British oceanography vessel, gets trapped in an ongoing set of giant waves that were completely unpredicted, completely unexpected, and really was very important for the understanding of giant waves in the open ocean because they had all the instruments on their ship. So in other words, it was like very not lucky for the people on the ship because it was a pretty harrowing experience, but they were able to measure the seas with real precision with these pressure sensors and things like that, and they were able to publish a paper that showed that here's what the weather forecasts and the marine forecasts and the wave models said we would encounter, and here's what we really encountered. Yeah. And, of course, that's what's happening to ships that are out there. They're encountering these unforecast, unpredicted giant waves at times.
It's you when you cited that statistic about the number of ships that are lost, and I think that it's also true that the number of ships lost in storms has significantly gone up over the last few decades, you wonder why it is that that isn't more of a story, that it is why it is that the media of the world haven't reported on this.
I that was certainly one of the reasons why I wanted to do that. And I spent a lot of time at Lloyd's of London, who are, of course, amazing record keepers. They have marine records and nautical records of ships going back to the mid-17th century, and they keep them in a very accessible form, and you can find out exactly what was happening to ships, and they keep statistics. And I, in the end, did not feel comfortable saying two ships a week. My reporting, the number I felt comfortable with after spending time at Lloyd's of London was two a month. But that's still a lot. That's still a tremendous loss that we don't hear a lot about.
The guest in this hour of Focus is Susan Casey, and her book is The Wave. It is now out in paper, and it is about big waves and people who are fascinated by them and try to understand them and in some cases try to tame them or at least try to ride them. So we're talking about scientists who are studying big waves, and we're talking about surfers who surf big waves. And it's a great story, both pieces, and it's out now in paper. So if you'd like to read it, Anchor Books is the publisher. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, I think also that part of your interest in waves goes back to your having seen some pictures, or maybe it was film, of this guy who's a very important part of this story. Laird Hamilton is his name, and I guess he is generally acknowledged to be the king of big wave surfers. You talked earlier about how you had been in Hawaii and seen people on maybe 20-foot waves, and I think the story is that you saw him, pictures of him, and he was on a 60-foot wave, and that you thought, okay, I've got to understand what it is that would drive somebody to do that.
Laird is a very singular person, and before he could actually ride a 60-foot wave, as if that's not daunting enough, he had to invent the means by which to do it. So in other words, he kind of had to invent his own sport, and he did. And that a wave that is too big to paddle into, which is for most surfers anything over around 40 feet. There's a few people in the world that can paddle into a wave at 40, 45, 50-foot wave, but not very many. The wave's just moving too fast. The surfer won't catch it. So they invented a technique called tow surfing where they used jet skis and they recreated their gear. They created shorter, very heavy but very sort of spear-shaped surfboards, and they put foot straps on them because, of course, the G-forces on a 70, 80, 100-foot wave would just throw you off the board. So Laird invented his own sport and then proceeded to show people that the impossible was possible in the ocean, and so he was always somebody that I was aware of because we're having worked at sports magazines and adventure magazines. We did see pictures of him riding this infamous wave called Jaws, which it was kind of his baby. And Jaws is the most beautiful, terrifying, snarling, gorgeous wave. It's It's like the Hokusai print, the great wave, the famous picture. That's Jaws. Jaws has got this perfect barrel. It's symmetrical. It's this beautiful sort of turquoise azure water in Hawaii. It's clear. And then, of course, it's so powerful that it's just mind-blowing. And that was where he was basically doing his test experiments, using himself as a guinea pig to ride these waves.
Yeah, it's just when you, again, I can't really quite imagine it, but if people can, and I think that I found myself also thinking about the Hokusai image of this giant wave that's curling around and is sort of frothy at the top, and then the place that where you ride is inside that curl where you get a kind of a almost pipe-like effect. So it's I can imagine that it's like the top of the wave is curling up around your back and sort of over your head. The thing I wonder is, when you're doing that, what is it you focus on? I guess maybe you focus on where you're going, because if you realized what was over your head, maybe you couldn't do it.
No, I mean, I asked that question many times to the tow surfers, which is, what does it feel like, And it really, I think, is just an amalgam of sensory experiences, maybe the noise, maybe the power. But I think what gets them, they really remind me of the Laird is often compared to Chuck Yeager, the famous test pilot. And the surfers that I met and the ones I traveled with and lived with, they remind me of the test pilots of the Right Stuff era, because a lot of the times no one knew what was going to happen when they did what they did. What happens when you're in the barrel of a 70-foot wave? Nobody had done it before. So they are really unique individuals in that regard. Like, they just but what makes them, I think, really compelled is a kind of addiction, a kind of calling. And I came to the conclusion that one of the things that really draws you in is that when you are on a 70-foot wave, you are in the moment. You're in the present moment. There is no past. There is no worrying if you left the stove on. There is none of the things that distract us. And that moment, that's the thing that people spend 30 years meditating to attain. And that sense of being fully alive and fully engaged in the real present moment, I think, is what is the true addiction. And in a wave like that, there is no other place you could be. And you really, they're also sort of conversely some of the more humble people I've met, because if you see a 70-foot wave, if you are looking at it, there really is no question about who's in charge here, and it isn't us.
Yeah. Well, sir, I found myself wondering about that same question, about what's the motivation, and I assume that it was something that people who do extreme sports, or maybe people who fly jet airplanes or race cars or ski jump or go barreling down a mountain at 100 miles an hour or whatever it is that they do, there's something about meeting head on that thing bigger than you are and testing yourself and what happens, no doubt, in your brain when that happens, that it's and I'm sure that it also becomes kind of addictive after a while. After you've done it and you feel that feeling, maybe you want to continue to feel that feeling, and that's why people keep going back. Whatever it is they do, that's why they keep going back and doing it over and over again.
Well, surfing is definitely addictive, and you are, when you're on a wave, if you are not thinking about, if you're thinking about what's behind you, what's in front of you, how you might fall off, you'll fall off. So it does the same thing even on a small scale, and it really is a feeling that I think we equate with happiness and peace and being actually present, really present.
Yeah. Now the wave that Jaws, the one that's there in Hawaii, is one of, I guess, a number of very well known named big waves, and there are various places around the world where they exist. But also people like him and people who are interested in these kind of waves, they go looking for waves.
Right. They're really on a global scavenger hunt for the biggest waves the ocean can produce. And in the southern hemisphere, the storms that produce them come now, between now and the end of August, September. And that could mean Africa. That could mean Australia, New Zealand, Tahiti, which is where one of the more fearsome waves is. So they basically have a year-long pursuit of the waves. And, of course, in the winter, we get the North Pacific swells and storms that create waves in Hawaii, all the way down the coast of North America and even sometimes into South America in the winter. So there's always a storm happening somewhere during the winter. But they might only get two or three opportunities to surf 50, 60, and upwards of that in a winter or summer.
How do people like Laird and there are others in this community of big wave surfers, and I guess it's really not a very big group of people because it's not something just anybody could do. How do they actually make a living? It's sort of my understanding that he's always really avoided the idea of being a professional surfer.
He never wanted to compete in any competitions because he really felt that what he was doing was more sort of a collaboration with the forces of nature that were so great in the ocean. And he, you know, but Laird is sponsored by a number of different companies, Chanel even, and American Express and Toyota. And I mean, he has basically sponsors. He has obviously, he's had a film career. He's also one of the things I loved about Laird was he's like the MacGyver of the surf world, and he keeps inventing different ways to ride waves. And he's now invented something that's caught on in a really big way called stand-up paddling, which is people have probably seen pictures of it. It's a bigger surfboard, and you can do it on a lake. You don't even have to ride waves. It's like you're standing, but it's a floatier board, and you have a long paddle. It's really fun because you can see fish and everything, and yet he's taken it, of course, in a completely different direction. He just wanted to find a way to make riding 40-foot waves more challenging for himself because he gets that a lot. And when you have ridden a 100-foot wave, 40-foot wave, it's like he needed to find a new way to make it difficult, to make the same sort of thrill out of a 40-foot wave, and that's what he created.
Yeah, it's just
he invented that surfboard, so he also has a company that produces them.
It goes back to this idea that it's kind of difficult to imagine this. I'm thinking about you. You were on with Jon Stewart on a Daily Show, and I think he said something to you to the effect of, "Why is it these guys just don't die? How can you do this and live?"
Well, during the first big storm that I went to on the West Coast with a group of surfers, someone did die at a wave called Ghost Tree, which is off the 18th hole at Pebble Beach. And it's a very scary wave because there's no room for error. If you're not in the right spot, you're basically going to get slammed onto the rocks. And so actually that particular day, I was just up the coast about 30 minutes at a wave called Mavericks, which had also had this year somebody died on Mavericks, a Hawaiian, and of course one of the more famous big wave surfers, Mark Fu, really tragically died there as well. So Mavericks is a wave that has killed several people and almost killed many more, I think. And that same day that I was at Mavericks, I was in a boat, and the captain, there was really no visibility, and the captain got really scared and turned back, and it was a terrifying experience even to be on the boat, just not even that close to the wave, but about 50 yards from where the captain turned back, unbeknownst to us because it was foggy and stormy and everything, a crab fishing boat capsized, and the two men aboard it were killed. The water there is like 55 degrees, and the boat was just smashed into smithereens, and they found like little pieces of it, and they found one body eventually, but they didn't find the other body.
I think he's 47.
Laird, yes.
Laird. So, and he's obviously a very fit and physically powerful guy. You also have to wonder, okay, how long can you do this?
Well, you know, of course, but I don't see any signs that he's peaked. So, you know, I wouldn't. I think that whatever the traditional rules are of when a person is supposed to hang it up or whatever, I don't see Laird conforming to those. But he trains, and his training is legendary, actually.
Well, and the other thing I guess I wonder is he is married, he has a family, he's married to someone who is equally athletic and beautiful as he is. They're you know, sort of a pretty stunning couple, the two of them. And so, but you also wonder about, you know, how she feels about this. You know her, I'm sure, and have talked with her. How does she feel about it?
Well, I mean, it was one of the first things I asked was, you know, Gabby Reese was a former professional athlete, volleyball player, and also, you know, very successful in other sports herself. And she, you know, she just said basically, this is who he is. And this is, I knew this. When I married Laird, I knew what he did for a living. And you couldn't live with him if he wasn't doing it. It is who he is. And I remember one time she said to me, you know, of course, I think, you know, what if he gets vaporized on a 150-foot wave? And, of course, you know, without giving away the climax of the book, he comes up against such a situation with some other surfers. And she just said, I would know that he was doing what he loved, and you know, there really is an alternative for a person who's that clearly in their what they were put on earth to do. And as I said in the book, it's as if nature set out to create a human being specifically for this pursuit, because everything about Laird's upbringing, I mean, his life story is so extraordinary that it almost seems made up. You know, he found his own father. His father was a professional surfer. His stepfather. His real father wasn't really around in the beginning. He was never part of Laird's life, and so his mother was raising him in Oahu, and she just happened to live on the beach at Pipeline, which is one of the most famous waves in the world. And Laird, of course, grew up in the most aggressive water in the world as a result of that. And so then one day he sees a young man, 17 years old, is walking along the beach and sees a kid body surfing, which is Laird. And Laird says to the guy, they play in the water a bit, come home and meet my mother. And this was Bill Hamilton, who was himself a pro surfer. He met Laird's mother, Joanne, and they were married. They got married. So Laird, kind of the legendary story is he chose his own father, and that man happened to be a professional surfer, who, by the way, also looked a lot like Laird.
It is an incredible story, and that is one of the stories that you can read in The Wave. And our guest is Susan Casey, the author, and we have a couple of callers here. We'll talk with someone in Belgium, the community in our neighboring Vermilion County. Line number four. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you both. Your guest mentioned that there are various hot spots around, and you, Mr. Inge, asked about it in different areas. And I know there are some spots where they happen fairly regularly. Half Moon Bay is one place that comes to mind. There's a place called Maverick there that invariably there's somebody killed there every summer. And they have very large waves that crash against essentially a, I don't know if I'd want to call it a reef out there or whatever.
It's a bunch of
stones or whatever it is out there. But the question I had is, now you said these ships disappear in different places all over the world. Is there any regularity where those spots are at? And if there is a regularity, do people ever surf those waves way out in the middle of the ocean?
Oh, wow, this is a great question. How much time do we have? So the first thing I want to say because people get confused sometimes, I wanted to write about all kinds of giant waves, and so there are rogue waves, also sometimes called freak waves. There are these giant storm waves that are created, as the caller said, by, you know, something on the bottom, and they happen in places where the surfers know to go to, like Jaws is a reef. And Mavericks is a bunch of ledges that kind of, they basically, the wave trips on it, the swell. And then there are tsunamis, of course, which is a completely different type of wave, which I also write about, and which we've seen tragic demonstrations of recently. But so, and then rogue waves that happen in the open ocean can happen under a number of different conditions. Several situations where rogue waves can form are understood by science, and they can be, to some extent, avoided, although it's a really volatile, nonlinear set of circumstances that creates them. So by definition, they can't really be predicted or pinned to a specific spot. But there are a couple places that mariners, of course, know they would rather not be. And usually there's a time of the year that also corresponds to that. So one of them, and a place where I spent some time in my reporting, is the southeast coast of Africa, from Durban, kind of from the tip of Mozambique down to the Cape. There's a current called the Agulhas Current, and it's a lot like the Gulf Stream, but it runs in the opposite direction. It runs from north to south, and it's incredibly powerful. And so coming up from below, you have all these southern ocean storms from Antarctica, and there's no landmass that slows those things down, so they just build and build and build across this long, long stretch of ocean and become very powerful. So you have this hot, fast current that just kind of, you know, collides into these really powerful, cold storms, and that's when you create what I call an oceanic train wreck, and the waves become very steep, and when they're unsteep, when they're steep, they're very unstable. And at the same time, sorry, cut me off if this is getting too technical, but the continental shelf is very close to comes out very close to shore. So because there's bottom features like canyons and things, the wave energies can sometimes focus. And when wave energies focus, then the rogue waves sometimes can almost be, it almost works like an amplifying, like if you imagine taking a magnifying glass and a a beam of sunlight and you can create something very powerful. You can create fire. That happens kind of with these bottom features. So during the southern hemisphere winter, ships would really rather not head around the tip of Africa, but a lot of the very big oil tankers that can't fit through the Suez Canal have no choice but to make that trip. And so as a result of it, South Africa has this fascinating culture of marine salvagers, which are like the tow surfers, but they work under even more extreme, dangerous conditions to save these oil tankers from breaking up in these crazy rogue seas.
So does anybody surf those particular ugly waves?
Yeah, you know, the thing is they're not that surfable, but it's been done. One of the great characters in the book is this meteorologist who has almost like a sixth sense of where rogue waves are going to happen. He's supernatural almost, and he pinpointed a part of the Agulhas Current and said to one of the surfers, for about an hour between 1 and 2 o'clock at these coordinates, you know, longitude, latitude, you're going to have 100-foot waves for about an hour. And so one of the marine salvagers actually strapped a jet ski. I write this whole anecdote in the book. Strapped a jet ski under his helicopter and lit out across the ocean. It was 100 miles out. And dropped the jet ski and the surfers, the driver and the rider, and the surfboard into the water. And they surfed these rogue waves. And there was a filmmaker who captured it as well. But, you know, the thing is, a lot of the times the open ocean waves just look different. They're longer wavelength. You know, they don't look as impressive as something like Mavericks, which is really dramatic and rears up and has a big crest. And these open ocean waves are giant, but they roll over long periods of time. They're just not as dramatic.
So they're not quite the same kind of surfing wave then, huh?
Not at all, because they're not being formed by a feature on the bottom.
They don't
a lot
have
of
that.
The time. You know, they're waves that have kind of just started breaking because they're so steep and unstable.
And so they don't have that lip that we think of it. They just go long wave.
Not exactly, no.
No?
Not exactly. To some extent, yes. And parts of them can break and other parts don't. If you just go on YouTube and you look at pictures of boats in really big storms, you can kind of see how they break. They break in pieces almost.
Thank you very much.
All right, thank you. In this hour, we're talking with our guest, Susan Casey, about her book, The Wave. And we'll talk some more after a short break. This is Focus.
Today's broadcast is made possible by the Friends of WILL and by the Great Impasta, a family-owned restaurant serving foods from northern Italy for more than 25 years. The Great Impasta, located in Lincoln Square in downtown Urbana. More information is available at 359-7377.
This is Focus, our morning talk program. We're here with 10 topics every week. You can check our schedule on our website. That's WILL.illinois.edu. Hour two today, it's our monthly show on dog care and dog behavior. Next week on the program, Monday, we'll talk with the director of the Krannert Art Museum on the University of Illinois campus. They're celebrating their 50th anniversary this year. We'll have our regular monthly show on diet and nutrition. Also, we'll be talking about severe weather, and in this particular case, we'll be talking about tornadoes. This particular tornado season has been the worst in something like 50 years, and scientists who study that kind of weather say they really don't know why. We'll talk with Grady Dixon. He's an assistant professor of meteorology and climatology at Mississippi State University. That's next week on Thursday. We'll also talk Friday with Charles Fishman about his book, The Big Thirst, which is all about the problem of water and water shortages around the world. And that's just a few of the things we have up next week. We're here, as I say, weekday mornings 10 until noon. 10 different topics. You can check the schedule on WILL.illinois.edu, and you can also listen to past programs. In this hour of Focus, our guest is Susan Casey. She is the author of The Wave, which is now out in paperback. It's published by Anchor Books, and it is about big waves and surfers and scientists, and it's a good story. She is the editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine, also is the author of The Devil's Teeth, a true story of obsession and survival among America's great white sharks. Well, Susan, I do want to talk about the science some. I don't want this just to be about surfers, but one more question I really do want to ask you, because as I said, the world of these big wave surfers is fairly small and it's very male. Are there any women who do this?
It is not a big sport that women would particularly want to do, but there is one young woman. She's 24 years old. Her name is Maya Gabriera. She's in the book. She's not. She's kind of. I wrote a profile of her as well. She's awesome, but she's not at a place in her career where she would compare herself to the best men yet. But she's really doing things that you know. She's breaking the mold for sure. I mean, one of the things that is a little difficult in tow surfing is that you need a certain amount of body mass because the wave's moving really fast, and if you're not going at a pace that's faster than the wave, it will just swallow you up or fling you over the falls, which is really dangerous. And I mean, I saw Maya take some horrific falls in Tahiti, and she's just very gutsy and interesting. And I expect in the future there will be some more women, but I don't expect it to ever be a sport where you're going to see a whole lot of women.
Yeah. Well, at one place, though, it actually that brings waves and women together is the science. There are actually a lot of women who are scientists who are studying this issue. Let's talk some more about what it is that science is hoping to learn here.
Well, I think that, you know, to me, what we don't know about the ocean is just so astonishing. And here we are, like, fascinated by space. But I always wonder, why don't we spend more exploration money and science money really delving into our own planet? There's just so many mysteries to the ocean, and I don't think I'll ever get tired of writing about them. But I think part of it is that we need to know in order to coexist. 60% of the global population lives within, I believe it's 30 miles of a coastline. We like being on the coast. We want to build buildings on the coast. We want to live in proximity to the ocean, so we have to understand how it works. I mean, one of the famous stories is during World War II, D-Day, and not knowing what the waves were going to do was just tragic. And they realized, hey, we really do need to understand how all the currents work, how waves work, and we really had not spent a lot of time on it. So wave science has gotten, I think, recently, and some scientists have said to me, a little bit more popular. It was always considered sort of a nerdy branch of science, but with Katrina and with some of the other things that we've seen, there's more funding going towards it. And, of course, there's tremendous fears about what climate change will mean in terms of the ocean's behavior. And I wrote a lot about that. We're in for – my contention is, and what all the scientists I spoke to agreed, was that we're in for a stormier, more aquatic world.
Mm. Well, that's it. It seems pretty clear that if you look at just look at statistics, I think one of the things that you write about is the fact that, again, over the last few decades, we're seeing, on the average, higher waves. And we're also the number of ships lost at sea apparently has also gone up. So that's, I guess, kind of understandable that maybe those two things would go together. But a lot of people are looking at this question of global climate, what that does, what that means to the ocean, the number of storms, and whether indeed we're going to have more trouble. And that's going to be not only a threat to shipping and to people who are on oil rigs, but it, as you say, there are a lot of people who live close to a coast. And that's likely to be a big issue there, too.
Very much. I mean, the Lloyd's of London sees that as the number one global risk is, you know, what climate change and rising ocean levels and increased storm volatility, what they seem to be able to prove right now. And climate change is so complicated that by the time you can prove it, it's kind of like the frog in the pot analogy. It's too late. But what they know is that there's more energy in the system, so the extremes are becoming more extreme. And whatever that means, you know, it could mean that cold is getting colder, or the big storms are getting bigger. It's just a very extreme batch of extremes. And, of course, the other thing they know with certainty is that the sea levels are rising. They don't know how fast they'll rise, but every projection, I think, is an under projection, and they're trying to be incredibly conservative about it. It's possible, and it certainly has happened in the past, that it could be quite a rise of a magnitude that we're possibly not expecting, and it could also happen more quickly than we're expecting.
Yeah. Maybe you could talk a little bit more about the rogue wave, and I'm not quite sure if it's something that's actually possible to explain simply, maybe not, but and I imagine also it's a difficult thing to gather data on, because being able to do measurements and take observations, I suppose, is also pretty difficult too.
Well, that's why that ocean research boat, the Discovery, being trapped in the north, it was an area of the North Atlantic in a storm off the coast of Scotland, was so valuable in terms of seeing this behavior and being able to actually scientifically document it. There have been some Well, there was a boat, a very large British vessel called the Derbyshire. It wasn't some old rust bucket of a boat. It was a beautiful, brand-new, state-of-the-art, big boat that went down in Typhoon Orchid off the coast of Japan, way out there, but still kind of that's the closest place, the country that was there. No mayday, no nothing, just boom, it was gone. And a lot of the times these ships, they might be Liberian ships with a Laotian crew and, you know, with a Panamanian owner or something like that. And I think a lot of the times it's like international news, it just doesn't make the front page of the New York Times. But here was a ship, British crew, really, you know, the British, very proud of their ships. They have great mariner's tradition there. They did three inquiries, and they managed to find the ships, and they sent down a submersible, a robot submersible. And the submersible was able to find the ship, and they were able to see that what had happened was waves had come at it from above, which means the waves had to be over 100 feet tall, and breached the deck hatches. Mm-hmm. And then when the hatches on a ship like that, on a cargo ship, when they're breached, the holds will fill, the compartments, the bulkheads will blow out, and the ship snaps like a pencil. And so they found that the stern was a mile away from the bow, and the amount of the amount of time that passes between when the wave hit and when the ship is completely at the bottom of the ocean is stunningly quick, like it's minutes. And so, and they were able to actually see what had happened, get metal, see that the metal had been ripped apart with such force. So they could see the aftermath of a rogue wave and what it was capable of doing and measure it more definitively, even if they hadn't seen the wave itself.
Hmm. I think you talked in the first part of the program about the fact that there are certain places at certain times that are known to be really dangerous, so that if you had a ship and you were plotting your course, there might be certain places you'd say, all right, we need to make sure that we do not go near this place X here, you know, on the ocean. I guess the goal, though, would be to have better kind of prediction so that you could give crews more of a heads up to say, stay away from this particular area. Is the idea that as time goes along, it might actually be possible to for scientists to understand what's going on here well enough so that they actually could, you know, the way the Weather Service says, well, we think in this particular geographic area today, there is a good chance of a tornado, that right. They would be actually able to do that with some body of water?
Yeah, I mean, they continue to refine their models and make them higher and higher resolution and understand more and put more information into them. And these wave models and climate models are incredibly complicated and powerful, and a lot of the times I think they have been very useful. Certainly nobody would want to, you know, plan to route a ship without consulting them, but what the discovery encountered was the sort of stark reality that what the wave models predicted and what the ocean had to say about the matter were two very different things. So, you know, obviously it's important to try to keep building the models and understanding more and all that, but is this ever going to be completely within our control to predict and understand? Probably not.
Hmm. We have maybe about 10 minutes, a little bit less left in this part of Focus, and Susan Casey is our guest. We're talking about her recent book, The Wave. It's just out in paper now. It's published by Anchor Books, and it is about big waves, various kinds of big waves, and people who are fascinated by them and drawn to them. Some of those people are scientists who, for good reasons, are trying to understand them, and some of the people she writes about in the book are surfers who are interested in riding them. And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. And the email is will-talk@illinois.edu. I know that you've been kind of interested in and been a water person, that is a water sports person, for a long time. You were a competitive swimmer when you were growing up, and as we explained, we're doing some surfing. Maybe that would explain your interest in these subjects. How did you get interested in sharks?
Well, you know, I want to write about the ocean because it's the thing that interests me the most, and I think it's both terrifying and beautiful. And what I particularly love is the intersection of terrifying and beautiful, which, you know, is kind of the definition of the sublime. And the ocean provides those kinds of things with regularity. And to me, great white sharks were the same thing. And I had heard about this group of islands off the coast of San Francisco called the Farallon Islands in the mid-90s and seen a BBC movie about the sharks out there, and they have a very large population that shows up every fall at the Farallones. Very, very large sharks, all adults, very mature adults, and no juveniles. And the scientists had discovered that it was the same sharks coming back year after year, and they had been studying them really under very unusual conditions, really behaving the way white sharks really behave. In other words, there was no chum in the water, there was no blood being thrown in, there was no cage diving with chum. So they could, because of the very strange setup there, they could observe the sharks in ways that they had never been observed before. And they started doing this in the 80s, which of course was the Jaws heyday era, and realizing they're so much more interesting than we ever knew. And we really know very little about them. It's just like giant waves, great white sharks and whales and a lot of the creatures in the ocean. We don't know very much. Giant question marks, even on the basics. And I have all these white shark science papers and books from the 80s and 90s written with all this certainty, and everything in them is wrong, we now know. Mm-hmm. So we're on a very, I think, almost a race against time to try to understand what's going on with white sharks and sharks in general so that, you know, we can maybe try to save them. I mean, they're really getting hit hard by our fishing practices and finning and things like that. And they have been through every global mass extinction. I really hope they can make it through this one.
Yeah. There's still people who hunt sharks just for the fins and take the fins and throw the rest of the shark back?
Yes. I mean, finning is a practice that is largely illegal, but I think that it's still, like all fishing things, it's illegal. People do it anyway.
Mm-hmm. So you, going back to the wave, you, because you really wanted to spend time with the people who were with the surfers, with the big wave surfers, you really had to join their community in a sense, or at least you spent a lot of time hanging out with them and being there on the water and by the water. You actually ended up moving to Hawaii?
I did. I lived right at Jaws, yes.
And do you still live part of the time in Hawaii?
Yes.
So that did this project actually end up changing your – sounds like this project ended up changing your life in some
Certainly.
Ways.
I mean, I really am an immersive journalist in the tradition of I don't want to just read about it. I'm going to go to wherever I need to go. If I'm going to write about white sharks, I'm going to get in the water with a white shark. I'm going to spend the time to understand the people. And in my particular – in both books, it took me 5 years to report because I just really want to be able to bring a certain level of richness to the subject that will take, hopefully, readers to a place where they've never been before, and most people aren't likely to see a 100-foot wave or hang out with a neighborhood of great white sharks. And so that's what I think I can do for readers, is really help them come with me on these journeys. And as you pointed out, my background in – you know, being comfortable around some pretty extreme water conditions has really helped me to be able to get to these places.
Well, that would seem to be natural enough, or at least that you would feel at home enough, or maybe it's a matter of being drawn to the element that got you involved in doing it in the first place.
Yeah, I mean, it could be a combination of both. I certainly know that I probably couldn't have written The Wave if I wasn't able to fend a little bit for myself in some pretty crazy conditions. Like, you know, at one point, in order to see something, I had to swim 4 miles through stormy seas. So, you know, it helps. It really has helped. It's been a very useful thing for me.
So how, I mentioned that, you know, this group of surfers, this small community of big wave surfers, they're men. It's almost exclusively a male deal. So you were spending a lot of time hanging out with these guys. How did they think of you? How did they receive you? How did you feel about that, being a woman with all these guys?
Well, you know, they all have the men in Hawaii that I wrote about, Dave Kalama, Laird Hamilton, Brett Lickle, some of the others. They all have wives and daughters, and so they, and in the Hawaiian tradition, you know, the women they really actually they were very. I think that what I always strive for is to be ignored. You just don't want anybody paying any. If you're being a great reporter, you just want to be there, and it's like perfectly natural for you to be there, and no one's thinking about, oh, hey, you know, here she is with a microphone in her face or something. They're just doing their thing, and you're there. So after a while, I think they really started just seeing me as somebody who was there, who was around, and I think it was actually easier for me as a woman in this very macho world because I didn't have to worry about any sort of antlers clashing against, you know, I didn't, I think it would be very very hard for a man to hang out with Laird. It was a lot easier for me, I think.
Yeah, I can. No, I can. I can totally. I think I can understand that totally. So, are you embarked on any project that of the scale of this now? Something new?
Well, I mean, I have a bit of a day job here.
Yes.
I work. I am the editor of Oprah's magazine, and I am. I love the magazine because our readers are such devoted readers, and so I would. I entirely expect that I will start on another Ocean book, but for the next little while, I will definitely also be doing some magazine feature writing in O. And you know, I think it actually takes time to find a book. A book almost finds you. And I always want to make sure that whatever I'm going to write about is going to hold my interest for 5 years, because that's probably how long it's going to take me.
Yeah. Well, you know, on this program over the years, I've certainly talked with a lot of authors. And I guess the thing that impresses me over and over again, and the thing that readers probably don't really appreciate, is how much time it takes to write a book, and whether that's you're talking about fiction or nonfiction, we could indeed be talking about 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 years in some cases of person's life.
Oh, yeah.
In being bound up in that, you know, that piece of paper, this bunch of pieces of paper that you hold in your hand.
Yeah, I don't think the world needs. You know, sometimes I look at a story and I think that actually this was better. It would have been better served if it was a long feature story as opposed to a book. So I want to make sure that my book, it really does justice to the book form too. Like I think the world doesn't need, everybody's overwhelmed with reading and the amount of information that we have to consume, and there's all kinds of different competing things for a person's entertainment dollars, and I think even almost most important, their time. That I really want to put something out there that's going to add something to their, something definitive to their experience.
Our guest is Susan Casey. The book is The Wave. It's published by Anchor Books. You might also enjoy her book, The Devil's Teeth, A True Story of Obsession and Survival Among America's Great White Sharks. She is editor-in-chief of O, the Oprah magazine, and her work has appeared in a lot of other places as well, Esquire, Sports Illustrated, Fortune, Outside, National Geographic. And Susan, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was fun.